only got one shot. It's like the because I look at having been a mountain biker, when you're there with the downhillers and even the sprinters to some aspect, because they when they come into their concentration, they're like at 150% concentration for a period. Whereas a GC rider has to see that. Well, I always put it as on-off standby in terms of mentality. As a GC rider, you spend a lot of time on standby on, and because at the tour, especially the way the tour is in the last 10, 20 years, you can't afford to switch off for any moment, which you probably end up in a crash or something.
G'day, legends, and welcome back to the Pro Stream Podcast, presented by Zwift Legends, episode 99. And how good was 98, by the way? Fabian Cancellara, last week's episode. I hope you guys enjoyed that one. But today's guest is another legend of really a similar era, and our first Tour de France GC winner. Of course, it's Cadel Evans, the Australian legend. Now, this episode has been a long time coming, and I have to shout out to my great friend Karen Jones, who helped sort this episode out, and I was pestering her for it as well. And Cadel is a hard man to tie down, and couldn't have done it without Karen. So this episode, originally, we wanted to get Cadel and talk with him the week before the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race, of course, the one-day race in the Geelong area earlier in the year. But as things turned out, we had to do a little bit later. And you know what? I think it worked out for the best, because Cadel and I talk about some great topics. First of all, we learn about the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race and just how it all came about and Cadel's role in that. And then we talk about some really exciting things. We want to hear about Cadel's favourite riders, who excites him in the modern peloton these days. And we also talk about a similar, I guess, circumstance that happened in Cadel's career. We talk about Jai Hindley and his current contract situation. The great man Jai, who I'm sure will get back on the podcast this year, he's out of contract this year with Bora, and he's got some eyes on him, put it that way. He's had a great start to the year, and you know, he's got teams after him. And so Cadel and I discussed that situation. You know, you can sort of re-sign at your current team, but you've got other teams looking for you as well, and you're in your best years to get the biggest contract, I suppose, that you'll get in your career. And so Cadel weighs in on that and sort of applies his own experiences and explains what he would do in Jai's position. We also talk about general classification riders, and Cadel details exactly what you need to excel as a GC rider, outside of obviously the physical and aerobic capabilities to be at the front. You know, there's more than that, off the bike stuff, and Cadel has lots of experience with that, and you know, he gives a great take. He really did his research for this episode. And then we talk about his favorite moments and favorite races, and you know, anyone that knows Cadel will know that he's a funny dude, he's an interesting character, and we do go off on many tangents, which is very funny. So Cadel, I have to say, the ultimate professional. I reckon he had notes for this episode. That's how prepared he was. And yeah, you guys are going to love this one. Definitely one of the best eps I've recorded on the podcast so far. And I know I've said that a few times, but hey, it rings true, and you guys will know at the end of this ep. Now, legends, the TPR, the cycling, not the cycling, the Press Room Cycling Podcast, it's sponsored by Zwift, you know, and Zwift is just the best indoor training platform going around, okay? There's other training platforms, but no one's on them, you know? The community isn't there. I think the biggest thing about Zwift is the community. You get on at any time of day, any time zone, and you've got thousands of people to ride with, no matter what you want to do. There's thousands racing, there's thousands in the group ride, there's just thousands out there in all the worlds. You can't beat it. And that's, I think, what makes Zwift so good. So if you're getting into that winter training or the sort of spring training, you want to do some hard gravel rides coming up, and you want to get in good shape without getting wet or just getting miserable, get on Zwift. They've got workouts for everything. And it's just the perfect way to keep your fitness going as we go into the winter season. Now, this is it. It's time to get stuck into the big episode. It's episode 99 with Cadel Evans. Legends, salut. I'll see you on the next one. You know, it struck me as I was riding home today that you're the first Tour de France winner we've had on the pod. We've had other Grand Tours, we've had world champions, gold medalist, and world champion as well, but first Tour de France winner. So that's a nice milestone.
So, all right. Okay. I'll take that.
Well, it's a nice setup you got there. I've seen it in other podcasts before that you've done, Cadell. It's a nice little office setting.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a bit of a mess over here where my paperwork's kind of like, okay, I've got to do that. I'll put it on my desk. That happens about 20 times. Then I sit down. I'm like, what did I have to do? Oh, I have to do this. So it's got accumulation of letters and, oh, man, people still send me stuff to sign and things like that.
Really? Like what? Letters and jerseys and stuff?
Oh, I don't know what's in here. I haven't even opened them yet. I think if you open a letter, you never respond, so I leave it unopened. Someone from Belgium sent something. I don't know. Maybe it's something to keep. It's pretty heavy. God.
It looks like a jersey. Yeah. Could be a jersey in there, too.
It feels like a book. Actually, it's the size of a Tintin book. Maybe it's a Tintin book.
Wow.
Coming from Belgium? Could be. Oh,
That's interesting. Well, Cadell, why don't we start? Because the first topic I'd like to talk about with you is, of course, the Cadell Evans Great Ocean Road Race, which has been and gone now.
Yeah, hang on. But before I do that, I haven't even had my coffee this morning yet. I'm getting kids off to school this morning.
Oh, beautiful. He's got the BMC espresso mug. That's fantastic.
I'm very BMC, as you could probably see from the outside.
Oh, I see the bike too.
Mm.
Beautiful.
That was a retirement present actually for when I stopped racing. Yeah. And I rode a bit on the rollers. I'm like, this is too nice to ride actually, but it's great because it's my exactly the same road position as I had that I raced on.
Really?
So it's always good to have one as a point of reference when you go back and I've got a new bike or something, you measure it up. It's like, hang on a second.
Mm.
Let me what go kind back. Of, so anyway.
What kind of coffee machine are you working with at home there?
I have it's a Swiss one, Olympia Cremina. Mm. So with a lever and
all the manual.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But when I got divorced, it was like, first thing I did, I bought myself a coffee machine. I did some research, but I live on a town which is on a spring. It has really hard water. So anything, you have lots of problems with water and things. I'm getting one that I can get serviced easily. So I bought a Swiss one, and it was actually one of the best recommended ones. Because I know we're going to be talking about Jai, because he loves the old Pavoni ones, which is that's what I wanted, but to get them fixed and things, and this is a better one apparently. So that's what I have here, and in our place we have a Rocket as well. Actually, that's a little bit easier and more consistent and more bling as well. So
bling. I think one of my friends has got the manual with the big handle actually at home. They've got one of those. They're super nice, but there's an art to it, isn't there?
Yeah, it makes it, I suppose in the end, it just makes it easy to step up making coffee, which you can actually do it simply. But it's that part of getting it right and so on. But anyway. We should get started like officially, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cadell,
it's great to have you on the TPR podcast. You know, your episode 99.
Is that a good thing to go in before the 100, or is 100 the last one? Or
no, I think none of the 100 certainly isn't the last one. The 99 is good. When I think 99, I think Shane Warne, because that was his highest Test cricket score.
Okay, I think Maxwell Smart, because as a little kid, you see Agent 99. She was so pretty. She seemed so pretty.
Oh, good one. Well, yeah, really nice to have you on.
Great to be here. Good to speak Aussie for a bit. I've been over in Europe for a few months now. Of course, I was over for my race and so on and stayed on for a few things. But been back in Europe for a few weeks and getting back to things here. And I had a dream last night and I was driving down the wrong side of the road. You know, those things that are different in Europe, mostly the seasons and the language and the mentality. But good to speak Aussie for a bit.
Mm. Do you speak what languages do you speak? Are you fluent
at home? I live in the Italian part of Switzerland. I live very close to Mendrisio, where the 2009 World Championships were. I lived here. I've been based here for 19 years now, so quite a while. since my Lotto days, actually. When I moved to Lotto, I also moved within here. And I have a 13-year-old son who lives just over the border in Italy. I live 500 metres from the Italian border, just over there, very close. So my partner, Steffi, just went off to get the shopping. So he gets in the car and goes to Italy and gets our groceries. It's very, very close. I have a 13-year-old son who lives over there, and that's why I'm still here. But where our plan is to come back to Australia and be based back in Australia soon, which for me would be my true coming back to home, and my home being Barwon Heads, which is the race passes through every year, the Great Ocean Road Race, I should specify, and so on. So anyway.
Wow. That's a great segue into the first question that I was going to ask about the great race, the Kid Oliver's Great Ocean Road Race. And, you know, we had it a couple of months ago, and the races were just, the women's and men's were terrific races, and the circuit, so exciting. But I wanted to know, when did the race, you know, start to form as a project, you know, not its first edition, but when, you know, were you starting to talk about this during your career? Or, you know, was it your idea? Did someone approach you? Like, how did the race actually come about?
The actual initiation of the race, it was a bit of a, sort of, as far as I know, even beyond before when I was involved with its formation, which sounds kind of strange, but I think the Victorian Tourism Commission was called, it was created by Jeff Kennett years ago. They had a separate department for major events, Victoria. Saw the opportunities that cycling had for, was so good for tourist promotion, which in the end, that's what the Tour de France is in the end. It's a huge tourist promotion for France, other than a fantastic bike race and everything. But it's they had this idea to do something like that. And then after the tour, the Victorian government had to be on their bonnet. They wanted to do something in my name. And I didn't really have an interest to have a road named after me or a statue or something. But when this idea came up, we'd like to have a race and we'd like to name it in your name. I was like, oh, that's a bit much. But, yeah, I'd love to have a bike race. And then the next question was, well, what should we do? And my ideas and my input came from the time in the calendar, the format of the race, the circuit, utilizing a little bit the world circuit, having the women's race, having the public ride, having a – I would also wanted like, of course, we have the elite and it's the pro, the world tour that really, that's what pays the bill, so to speak.
Yeah.
I also wanted something, for me, cycling is something, I suppose, cycling for me obviously was a racer, goals, Tour de France, that really elite level. But now I step away from that. I want to bring more people into the sport or help people's quality of life through cycling. And while you inspire those with the world tour men's and women's, it's getting people on bikes. It's having the politicians come on the people's ride and having the AFL footballers being a bike rider for a day and those things. I suppose it's that thing that's I want to go broader than just the elite level racing hopefully it's one thing to inspire people, but first inspire, then actually get them to do and start and make action. And it's really I suppose when I set out on this was, okay, we'll have a race, how it's going to fit in with, you have to fit in with your local community, you have to fit in with the World Tour calendar, you have to fit in with the top teams, the top riders, because, of course, you want the top riders coming and competing in your race and getting into the World Tour and those things. But also had this same thing of sort of, it was like, I hope that one day, or maybe in the past, it's actually happened, was that family's going to go and watch the race, and a little girl, a little boy, they're going to sit on the side of the road and they're going to watch a bike race go by. And like, oh, maybe I'd like to try cycling, and they'll come back and win the race. We haven't quite gone that far, but we have this little thing where we have this at the start of the men's race where we have this little ride out with some kids.
Yeah.
And it's the Geelong Port lead out now. And a few years ago, this used to be the Vegemite lead out.
The Vegemite
jerseys. And we look like jars of Vegemite on bikes. And anyway, one of the girls who participated in that was in the race this year racing with the World Tour Women's teams, which I thought was a huge step. But that's really what we want to do, is inspire people for the future, and not just young people coming into the sport with elite level goals, but just people choosing to do some activity as opposed to none, or choosing cycling as a sport to do along with other sports, or promoting the coffee shop rides, and local businesses bringing businesses to them on a weekend after the school holidays, and on all these different aspects, trying to fill in all these aspects, so everyone will, in the end, also you want everyone to want to have the race as well, because that makes it much easier to organize when people actually want to have it.
And that young girl, Lucinda Stewart, was her name, and she ended up winning the Melbourne Awarney, or the Colac Awarnable, which is of course the women's race this
Glad
year.
I've got you to here to join all these dots together for me.
Yeah, because Karen told me that right after the race. When and Lucy, she listens to the podcast. She's probably listening now. Awesome. Absolute Hello, beast. But yeah, that's right. Yeah, and Karen
well, if
told
you can
me
win
that
the
right
Colac
after.
Awarnable, yeah.
Yeah, so that's really cool how it can come full circle like that. And I heard, I'm not sure who, maybe it was on a different podcast I was listening to, but I heard the numbers that you had for the people's ride were huge, like a couple of thousand.
Yeah, we normally go over 3,000. I think 3,800 has been our biggest number of participants. We'd like to have more. It's in Australia, it's the insurance aspect is making it's a real hurdle for as a racer. Like I speak as a race organizer here, not as a rider, but it's just ridiculous the costs in some of those things.
I know.
And when I speak with like the Schleck brothers or something, that their insurance fees that they pay, they're paying a 50th or 100th of what we pay.
Really?
In terms of insurance per rider. And you're sort of like, okay, well, we're trying to do the right thing, make the riders available to anyone, because if you have a high entrance fee, it was interesting. I was listening to see another podcast, what is it, a publication who's given up on their public ride or their grand fondo because of the insurance things. And then it was sort of nice to hear it from the other side, where often we're receiving the criticism, it's too expensive. But here was a media outlet saying, oh, we've stopped doing this because it's just too expensive. And if you ever see an entrance fee of this, it's completely justified, because you pay this amount of entry fee and that goes to insurance. And then you've got this to do road safety, feeding, road closures.
Oh, the road closures too. That's another
which
one.
It's been exponential, not only with inflation, but you get more roads built, so you actually have more intersections, but that's actually the small aspect of it. What's really sped it up is the you have an increase in safety levels, which is an increase of expertise, which is an increase of people, which is an increase of trained people, which each one costs more. 10 years ago, we it was great that the Lions Club from the Surf Coast used to have some volunteers and to close off small side roads, and now we have to have a certified person at every intersection who costs X amount of dollars an hour. And but when you have 170-kilometer road race, it's quite a lot of intersections you cross, and so it's a lot of people.
Now, the road race is terrific, and you mentioned you know your sort of input into selecting the time on the calendar, which you seem to have done such a great job, because as other races have appeared and disappeared and shifted, Cadell's had still remained at a really good space on the calendar. So I just think about the Bay Crit. The Bay Crit's kind of squeezed out of the calendar in a way, but as Nationals and TDU has evolved into a longer race, Cadell's is just sitting in such a good position to be attractive to teams to stay.
Thanks. Well, what I really wanted to do was, when I was going through this to answer the question, 2012 when this started. So 12 years ago, sitting down and where do you go in the calendar? What sort of race do you have? And what I wanted to do was be something that fitted in with what was already there, and also fitting in with the way cycling was going. In 2012, we go back, that was like the start of the Sky era, where Brad Wiggins had his big year and he was basically living at altitude and going to races. So it was really the start of big commitments from athletes to be traveling and away from home. But what I saw was this shift in cycling going to this commitment and the need to prepare well for a season beforehand. It's like, well, rather than go to the races in Spain or Portugal where you can still get rained or snowed on or not be able to train well, come to Australia. Also going in with the growth of cycling needing to be a little bit more international, or becoming more international. There's a conflict here. We're becoming more international in the participants and the sponsors, but we seem to be losing international races for the reasons we were touching on before, road closes, expenses, travel expenses, and so on. And then going forward, fitting in with what's already there, not adding huge extra expenses for teams in terms of travel logistics and expenses. And why not Australia with the seasons be the start of international cycling? We've got the good weather, we've got summer holidays, we've got people do it under a big part of its success is it's in the school holidays and people can go and watch the stages midweek.
Yeah.
And then us being a one-day race, we're not trying to be Tour Down Under. We're trying to fit in with Tour Down Under, fit in with the calendar, fit in with the whole, be what's hopefully an important piece of the jigsaw to make it all work. We're a one-day race. We can run on the weekend, and so that weekend fits in well. And then going forward, it depends. This year's the Olympic year, so all the races are 1 week earlier. Basically, the Olympics are on, so the Tour de France. Okay, we'll go 1 week earlier, and then everyone else is like, well, we have to go 1 week earlier, and that's where the squeeze comes in the middle, because also we've had so many additions to races over the years that every weekend's kind of full. So by moving 1 week, there's someone's got to pay a compromise, because remember, not so much now, but when we had the races in December in China and right at the end of the season after Tour of Lombardy, which already seemed, it doesn't seem so long ago that a long season seemed, I would race Tour of Lombardy and I'd go to the Tour de France presentation. I'd sit next to Cav or something. He's like, oh, you look lean. I'm like, I finished my season 2 days ago. He's finished his season, had his rest, and he started back for his next year. Isn't this a whole different it's just a whole different mindset. But then when after Tour Down Under, when there's other races, after Tour of Lombardia, there's other races. But then if we're moving Tour Down Under forward, and where's the off season going? And
exactly,
and that's also the thing for the teams now, which is to be ready for Tour Down Under, is becoming. I've heard stories where, some of the teams are finalising their sponsors in December, but they need jerseys to race in. So maybe the clothing supplier for a team has to be open on Christmas Day to print the jerseys so that they can take them to Tour Down Under. I think I've heard stories. I don't know how true it is, but there's the stories I've heard.
It's really fascinating, and the how it all works behind the scenes is interesting. And Cadell's has been very successful. Now, you mentioned you'd love to see the numbers of the Fondo, the People's Ride, grow. But what about the World Tour race? What are your hopes for the future additions in that?
That's where we'd really like to see more growth, more teams coming and participating. Unfortunately, we've come in this period where we had, of course, for everyone in the world, especially if you're in Australia, the whole COVID pandemic setback, and we're rebuilding after that. But what's been our biggest hurdle from that is the cost of flights flying people over, putting on accommodation, everything. All of those things cost a lot more. And while we'd love to have every World Tour team in the race, that also becomes really, really significant.
Big logistical exercise too.
They're a huge added expense to what we already have. But where I'd really love to see it is a much better quality, deeper field. And that also goes back to this change where I was in 2012 anticipating this importance of building up for the early season and the importance of training, which has become really clear. And I think if we look at Van der Poel comes off first race of the year with Milan-San Remo, I think, and obviously his performance there showed that he can come off a good period of training and race really well. That training has become so important now that a team like Lotto Visma are like, 5 days in Australia extra, no, we'll come back to adapt for the time zone to be ready for the next race. These are decisions now that previously were made by a team manager or a team director. Now they're being made by the coaches or a sports scientist or something. Yeah. And they're an example where they're really sort of taking that to the next level. But at the same time, the results are showing. So the other teams are going to have to shift, adapt, copy what they're doing. And so that at this point doesn't show enough either.
Okay, well, let's move on to my next sort of topic I'd love to chat about is who in the Peloton currently, Cadell, excites you? There's just so many riders at the moment that do so many exciting things on the bike, you know, men's and women's. We've got Lotte Kopecky, Puck Peterson, the cyclocross rider, you know, Vanderpoel, Pogacar, the list goes on. But I'm really interested to know that who excites you these days in the racing?
Yeah, good question. I've become a real fan. I'm just watching from the sides and read the results and so on. And if I look back on Milan San Remo, for example, especially I don't have little kids, so I don't watch all that many bike races, and I go to even fewer bike races, unfortunately. I'm in the small children phase of life. I go to playgrounds and things like that. I think if I take Milan San Remo that we just recently had, what amazed me was Vanderpool's performance. One, coming out of just training, that was really impressive. But also his who in not just the modern era ever would put themselves in a position where they can win Milan San Remo and get a signal over, I'm gonna risk all this chance, a great chance to win. He only had to follow Pog or maybe do two turns. Pretty sure he could have beaten Pog in the final. For his teammate, I was like, chapeau, everything you've done on the bike, amazing that. But to be able to do that is respect for your teammate, respect for your team, and to put that on the line, that I really, he really amazed me by what he did there. But at the same time, when people look at the results, you know, I got 10th or 11th, I think it's. But that amazed me and impressed me. Pogacar leading into it, he had to go much earlier on the Poggio, whether he didn't have the legs or for whatever reason that didn't happen. Still, yeah, amazing ride, but with all the, I think also when you go into a race as the overriding favorite, it's obvious what you have to do. It becomes a bit, maybe not impossible to do, but very difficult. And that sort of cancelled it all out, I think, unfortunately, because it would have been really interesting to watch him go absolutely like bottom to top and see what he did. I'm thinking back to maybe what Pantani did in the 90s or something. It would have been a comparison or something like that. But so the riders, I'm drifting away from the question here, but riders as a fan, I enjoy watching like the really big guys winning, but it's more these guys who are sort of, we have this tier of riders who it's sort of like everyone's racing behind them. So when I saw like the Yates brothers swapping off in the stage the first stage into Spain, the road stage into San Sebastian Donostia last year, I thought, like, for all the talk that was around Vanderpoel attacking on the last climb and this, and like I see them, and that was like a real goosebumps moment. I thought, as a father, I got two sons. I'm like, as a parent, what would you be thinking? I that was a moment in the tour where I was, how awesome is this sport? Vanderpoel's manner and commitment to his team, or dedication to his interests of his team in Milan San Remo. Pogacar's just want to win. Healy, that's a rider I really like. He's sort of like the second tier coming through. He's a rider I really like. I know we're going to speak about this later, but I met Roglar years ago, before he'd won over Vuelta, before he'd won some races. Really? And so I became friends with him. I was at a Gran Fondo many years ago, and for some reason he was there doing it, and he rode slowly with me as a, not racing as a pro anymore. I can't ride nearly as fast as I used to. Well, certainly not over that kind of distance. And I got to know him there, and I became a real fan of his, actually. And got, funnily enough, I was out doing the ride, and I come back, and my partner was sitting there with his fiance, now wife, mother of children, and so on. And they were talking as well, and they were both skiers, and so on. Him coming from another sport, me sort of coming from another discipline of the sport. I suppose we had a lot in common in that regard as well.
Roglic is a fascinating character. I can remember an article that this journalist, Kate Wagner, had written, and she was really known for her architectural reporting, and she moved to cycling. And she wrote this profile on Roglic, and it's she's famous for these big, long, deep, really endearing profiles on big riders, Kate Wagner. And she did one on Roglic, and it was very early days before he'd won the Tour, but he had shown that he was a competitor at that point. And it was a really good article. And we actually had Kate on the podcast talking about it, but it was that article, Kate Wagner, Roglic, if you're looking it up, that really turned me onto Roglic as a human before a bike rider, because she really captured what he was like. Yeah.
What amazed me when the first time I talked with him, he said that the training and the time they spend with psychologists, because for a ski jump, you have such a small amount of time that you can't be not concentrated for a second. It's not like a 6-hour bike race where you sort of need to lose concentration every now and then, otherwise you get too fatigued. Whereas the amount of time that they do working with a psychologist just to, it's like, well, it's like we do in cycling what we would the time that we spend to doing like base miles or just like endurance, they spend with the site working with the psychologist
to go through that sport.
I don't know. I was always one riding my bike, not working with a psychologist.
Tell you what though, when you're at the top of those ramps,
it's a whole realm that I haven't done much work on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you're staring down the barrel of those big ramps that those downhill skiers have to go, you probably need to be pretty dialed in.
Yeah, I've only got one shot. It's because I look at having been a mountain biker, when you're there with the downhillers and even the sprinters to some aspect, because they when they come into their concentration, they're like at 150% concentration for a period, whereas a GC rider has to sit it. Well, I always put it as on-off standby in terms of mentality. As a GC rider, you spend a lot of time on standby, and because at the Tour, especially the way the Tour is in the last 10, 20 years, you can't afford to switch off for any moment, which probably end up in a crash or something.
Mitch Docker always said that as for a sprinter, particularly him as a leader, I remember he said it once, was the sprinters, you almost... You're switching off at the start of the stage, and then the closer you get, 50, 40, 30 Ks to go, 10 Ks to go, you're getting more and more dialed and tuned in and switched on towards that finale.
Yeah, they're building into it. And then what amazed me, having been teammates with like Zabor and Robbie McEwen, these guys, is that as a GC rider, you're looking at things and you're being quite analytical about it, and watching where riders are, thinking where they are on GC, how much did that rider, if sometimes you're on a climb or something, how much did that rider lose in the time trial in the first week? Okay, how much can I calculate them to allow them in the breakaway if they're threatening to your GC or something? But then as a sprinter, they go through every like kilometer. Okay, at 1.5 to go, he was here, they were there. And they're just as analytical, but it's in this really concentrated period, but everything's happening really quickly, but they're reacting to everything really quickly and they're remembering everything really quickly. And I remember one of the directors of Zabel said, he's like a computer. You ask him results from 10 years ago or whatever, and he can remember every result. And then like Robbie, when he gets back to the stage after the race, and he's watching, and as a non-sprinter, you're watching who's going in, who's leading out, who's following the lead out or whatever. And he'll be like, where was so-and-so there? Oh, look, so he was back there. So how did he get up there? Oh, he followed him. And then I suppose Robbie's looking at it more of the chess game end of the spectrum than bike race end of the spectrum.
Wow.
As a bike race, you're watching who's leading, who's which team's on front, which team's coming up the side, whereas he's sort of looking who's going through the middle hidden that after you know the results, of course, a different analysis. But just to speak how analytical the sprinters are in this short period, and that concentration required for that period really is incredible. As same for downhillers, and my partner's a downhill skier, and for that 2 minutes or 1 minute, they're like, for me, I was like, it takes me 4 hours just to get into the.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, that's really cool. I haven't actually thought about it like that, the different levels of concentration and the time periods that they're in. So Big talk I want to talk about with you, Cadell, and I just thought you'd have an interesting take on this. And it's funny, after I'd sent you the list of, our little run sheet, an article dropped yesterday from GCN where someone had done some research and talked about some transfer news that's going on. And I wanted to talk about Jai Hindley because I was thinking about him the other day, the great man from Perth. And his situation at Bora Hunt Grower at the moment, he's had such a good, pretty successful time with Bora, and his contract is up this year. And I wondered, the news is that Bora want to re-sign him. He also seems recently that he's keen to stay with Bora. He likes that setup. But I do know that Jayco Alula are also keen to bring as many as those top Aussies back to their squad as they can. And when you consider that Jai maybe isn't the number one GC rider there anymore, whilst Roglic is there, at least for the next few years, and Vlasov is there too, and Martinez. I wondered what you would be thinking in this situation if you were Jai. What would be some of the thoughts you would be thinking about when considering your future? And this would be probably his biggest period of his career where he can get his biggest contract. He's at his peak. He's got some great results behind him.
He's certainly at the peak of his career, and really in the moment of fulfilling, he's reached his like I wouldn't say he's reached his maximum potential, but he's right there fulfilling his maximum potential right now. So in terms of a rider manager, now's the time they want to be managing Chai. If I wasn't on the little kid period of my life, I would have gone for a ride with him this week. He's just moved to where I am in the south, in the
Oh,
Italian part of Switzerland,
brilliant.
like, so I know he's home this week. But I'm on a little kid program, and so yeah, I go for a ride out during I go for a ride at lunch hour. The boys are in there eating their lunch. It is pretty cold here in the mornings as well. So, but he I think an interesting question, and I'm a fan of, I was sort of a fan of Roglic before Jai really came into his fore. I'm still a fan of Roglic. I'm a big fan of Jai. Really like him and the way he races and his character. And he's almost a neighbor for me as well now. And the Jayco team, obviously being an Aussie, I'm a fan of them. And if I can go back to an earlier period, and maybe your question made me think back to, even if we go back as far as someone like Greg LeMond had this issue. Phil Anderson had these issues. I had these issues as a racer, where as Australians or outsiders, we're at a good level, but maybe there's a Dutch team that has a Dutch rider the same, or a Belgian or a French or a, and that's been a compromise to our career at some point. I think it was LeMond most of all who would have won another Tour de France. He was on a French team, I think. Is that correct? On La Vie de Claire, La Vie Claire. I was going a bit more bit before even my time. As an Aussie, I'm here, I was like, I'm there, especially when I was early in my Tour de France career. I'm sort of like there, but no team would fully commit to me and believe in me. Okay, we'll have you on the team, but we're not going to build a team around you. We're not going to And it wasn't until BMC actually, and then that they really built a team around me and focused on me, and that's where my best results came. But of course, being an Australian, there wasn't an Australian team that had that benefit of like a, when I was at a Belgian rider doing fifth is probably as much publicity for them as me being on the podium, as a non-Belgian being on the podium. So for them, it's easy to get fifth later. Or, if we can get fifth, just to give perspective on in that regard. So now here finally, oh, there's an Aussie team. And obviously, like Simon was fourth at the Tour last year. He's won a Vuelta a España. They're a really capable team. It seems like it would could be a possibly really nice fit. But I'm just thinking further into it. Jai's built himself a great thing with Bora. He has I think, a great team that believes in him, and kudos to them. Going in, following him, believing in him, winning the Giro, he delivered. And now Roglic's come along and sort of like, hang on a second. That's not like in Jai's point, that's not what he did. He didn't build this team for Roglic, he built it for himself. But at the same time, Simon Yates has been at Ola, So I've got a delivery coming for 10 years. So if Jai goes there, it's going to be
a similar reverse.
It's going to be kind of the same kind of thing in some ways. Whether Jai being Australian going to an Australian team, I don't know, is Simon staying at the team after 10 years in the team? I guess he probably will. Obviously has a good thing going. Is Matt White and the guys there better communicators? So they're already talking to Yates about this possibility. Maybe Jai doesn't want to leave Bora at all. There's sort of a lot of factors in it, but just on the surface of things, I don't know if it would be such a, it may not be such a step up, but it might be just the same situation in a different team, which...
That's interesting. Yeah, I see exactly what you're saying. And, you know, I think for Jai, it's at Bora. Say, for example, in the situation of the tour this year, you know, Jai went last year with no pressure, which was fantastic, and he had such a good ride and would have had maybe a slightly better GC position had he not crashed at the end there, but it was still fantastic. Won a stage. He was in the jersey. I mean, we went wild here in Western Australia when that was happening. When I think about it at Bora currently with Roglic, when they go to the tour together, it's almost really fitting for Jai because he probably won't be considered the leader of that team and he'll be considered maybe the second, you know, like a Seb Kuss role. And that can be quite... nice, you know, like in terms of there's not much pressure, but also when he performs and Roglic wins or he gets up there as well, it's almost a win-win, you know, to be in that position.
Yeah, and this depends on also the team managers, the aspirations of the team, the goals of the team. But I think if I was in Bora's position, I'd be like, well, no, we're not going there with one leader, which is, seems to be the thing. The way they are going, okay, it's everything on Roglar. No, we're going there with two. One's not going to compromise the other, but in two, you're going to be better off than one there. It seems from the outside that what I can take, also from the inside, they're putting everything on Roglar. I think for Jai, okay, this is a situation. Let's make the best of it.
Yep.
And a lot of things can happen in a race like the Tour de France. So going there as second guy isn't such a bad thing. It does have its advantages as well. So we haven't got a choice, but look at the positive aspects of that situation and make the most of it.
I actually really like the comment you said at the start with regards to Jai's. He's getting the most out of his, like he's getting the maximum out of his potential. I think that's a really good way to describe his career so far, and he's still got a lot more to give. That's a great way to describe it. Now, I wanted to, we sort of touched a little bit on this, my next question, but with regards to GC, general classification riders, across 3 weeks, across 1 week, even across four stages perhaps, outside of the physical ability, Cadel, to obviously compete at the top and be that type of rider, what other attributes do you need to succeed as a general classification rider, and particularly from your career days? What were those things that you think worked for you?
Tolerate stress. I'd say that's a bit of an underestimated one. People don't realise that. Oh, you see, as a pro, you see riders who have been racing for years and they get themselves in a leader's jersey or something in a stage race, and they're like the attention and the... all of a sudden everyone wants you, which is, I find sort of, going back to Milan San Remo on the weekend, so they didn't know who won, so people didn't know who to crowd around, and then it's confirmed that
Philipsen
yep. took it, and then all of a sudden everyone went to him, and so it was like, well, hang on, they both did great rides, they're both awesome athletes, shouldn't we be? Yeah, it's sort of like, no, I just want to be with the guy who won. There's this whole, it's like this magnet of attention. But unfortunately with attention, it's attention from everyone. Everyone wants your attention and all of a sudden you don't have time to think because you're just inundated with attention, whether it's TV cameras and people. But anyway, stress tolerance is a very underestimated.
What did you do to de-stress, Cadel?
Well, it's funny that the thing for me was being at BMC was just having someone manage this like attention thing. It's like, okay, you've done this, now go and have a rest. Just go to your room and just go and have a rest.
Right.
And because you're at the tour, you don't have a lot of time. It's not like you're going to go out for a walk in the forest or something, because one, you're in a hotel or a city, and as soon as you walk out of your room, there's people, journalists, everyone just walking around, and you know, it's not a hotel. It's the Tour de France is in the town. So there's a lot going on, but I just read a book or something in my room, but just really you're tired. It's not like you feel like going and doing something. Often when you're having a real tough Tour de France, to get up out of bed to go to the toilet, there's already something you have to think about. You think about it twice because you're just so tired.
So sometimes just that time to yourself is actually a de-stress time.
Yeah, no one talking, no one. And now with telephones and social media and things, your brains always have attention in that regard as well. So that time alone, which I think it's not just the Tour de France, people don't have anymore, but that's what I think I missed about it. And that's where I think I probably started cycling much later, much earlier than a lot of people in the sport today. But just being alone on the bike and hearing the birds and feeling the wind in your face and things, that's something that today when I go out on, like I started just racing 35 years ago or something. I did my first race 33 years ago. Like that's when I was started to be attracted to cycling. Lots changed, obviously, but that still today is something that I love about the sport, being on your bike and rolling down the road or rolling down the trail or climbing up a hill or doing a descent. That's that freedom and no, just you and the bike and that's just saying this in life today, we don't get many times where we're not stimulated.
Yeah, big time.
We don't have external stimulation, and in our psychology, that's something that's probably strong in my psychology, because growing up in the Northern Territory is the only, I think, one or two white children in Aboriginal settlement.
Wow. Yeah.
Time alone, in my DNA, I have a lot of, but just that, yeah, being at the tour with all that attention, just stepping away from that and having time to think and reflect. Mm. And also you're riding it's a pretty physically, mentally hard race to do.
Yeah.
It's nice just to be able to analyze it a bit and think about things and try and anticipate things and visualize and those normal things that most people in other sports have sometimes too much time to do.
Well, very good answer. Now we can move on to one thing I'm really keen to hear about is one of your favorite moments in your career, Cadell. I'm sure there's so many. It probably was hard for you to choose one. But yeah, what was a real favorite moment from your career and why?
When I look back now, as time passes, you sort of step back further away from the sport, which you also have a little bit more perspective, which is good. So I suppose as my perspective changes, maybe my favorite moments change. But the things that really stand out to me now were obviously the tour and the time trial in Grenoble and the Galibier stage was the Thursday, 4 days from the end.
Yeah.
That was an example of my abilities as a bike rider, but everything was there on show. This is me. This is everything I've got. And I've had the legs to deliver. 2008 against Sastra on Alpe d'Huez, I was in the same situation. I'd had a crash a week before. I wasn't quite at my best. It was a bit of a strange situation with politics and Spain and teammates and things. Whereas that Galibier, I was in the same situation, but I was riding better and I could really show what I could do. And I have to say that was 2011 was 20 years since I'd watched my first Tour de France, which was also the first year I did my first bike race. But that was like that. I think it was 6.5 Ks or something that I went to the front with Contador and took over, sort of took control of the race. But that was 20 years of experience all put into use that day. And it was that really going back to the stress thing and performing under pressure. It was staying calm because when you often as a GC rider, you find yourself in the as the Tour de France, and not just the Tour de France, a lot of most races. To win it, you really got to be playing there, win lose, and like to be able to sit there and do that with a world title or a Tour de France or something. It's not as easy as it may sound.
Wow. Okay. Great answer. And what about your, let's say, your favorite race, Cadell, and it can't be the Tour, has to be outside the Tour. That might not be your favorite, but maybe your favorite race when you were riding, when you were racing, and now yeah. Your favorite race to spectate that you've finished.
It goes back a little bit to the one of the points of my career, the Strada Bianca stage to Montalcino. It was the first time a gravel stage was in a Grand Tour. I have to say, the Strada Bianca was a race I wanted to perform in as a rider. Mm-hmm. As it became known, I think the first edition was won by a Swedish rider, Thomas, surname escapes me right now. But I sort of saw it as an ex-mountain biker. Oh, I want to do that race. And even then, being going as a race organizer, I looked at that race, and that's a race everyone wants to do. But it became a real classic specialist race, and it's sort of the dynamics of the race changed while I was doing it. So I could never get there as sort of sharp and as good as I wanted to, because I was building towards Tirreno or other races. But anyway, that's a race I love to watch because it's just such a beautiful area. And when we had the closures in Italy for the pandemic and everything, and open, and oh, let's go watch Strada Bianca, and we jumped in the car and went down as a family and booked a bed and breakfast nearby in Asciano, and rode our bikes down and watched the race go by. And so that's one of the things I go back to Australia. I'm going to miss Van der Duhem and from Australia. Oh no, let's just jump in the van and go watch Strada Bianca in Tuscany. But that's living in Europe, one of the benefits. But as a fan, certainly Paris-Roubaix, Strada Bianca. Of course, I watched the Tour. I did some commentary when Jai took the yellow jersey. You guys were jumping out of your skin. I was commentating on English TV. I had to be a bit calm. had to channel my stay calm under storm GC mentality. Yeah, he's riding really well. He's going to run to the gym. hide my excitement. But of course, yeah, I watched the Tour in the mountain stages. But as a fan, I suppose my number one race to watch is just probably a bit boring. Paris-Roubaix, like everyone.
That's great. Yeah, I love.
Races that I wanted to race. Yeah, I love to ride Strada Bianca, but the classic specialists and their teams sort of became pretty specialized in that. The Giro was a race that I really liked as a rider to participate in. The Tour is the biggest, the most prestigious, and certainly the one that every rider wants to win, and to wear the yellow jerseys amongst the most prestigious, that and the rainbow jerseys, the most prestigious jerseys in cycling. But the Giro, in terms of participating and going to and being at, I found less pressure, less excitement, less stress. So you could actually enjoy it a bit more. Whereas to be the Tour, unless you're winning, it's sort of pretty hard. I found it hard to enjoy because I had a lot of expectations on me when I was at the Tour. But, if I wasn't winning, those expectations weren't being lived up to, and so therefore everyone was disappointed.
Yeah, no, I've heard of some other riders also say the Giro, just such a beautiful race, organized well, and I mean, when you get the weather right there as well, and the weather's nice, it's
do you get everything in the Giro? Yeah, absolutely everything. You know, well, you don't get the stellar hot days, but after you're ridden over the Gavia in the snow, 20 degrees feels pretty hot when it's 2 days later or something. It's still a big change for the body to adapt to. The Giro, they say in cycling, the saying is going to the Tour is like going to the circus, going to the Giro is like going to the museum for the people and the crowds. Yeah. And one thing you feel at the Giro is in Italy, everyone's very passionate and proud of their Giro. So you go to a hotel and the family that runs the hotel, they're so happy to have you because you're in the Giro d'Italia, and they just want you to have the greatest experience at the hotel, and they're just so happy to have you. and you go to the stages, and it's really the school kids out as the race passes their school, or the people who have been going to the same cafe for maybe 30, 40 years.
Yeah,
and that year the Giro starts, the stages starts right there or something. And they're just they're really happy and proud of it. Whereas going to the tour, because it's so big and such a exciting event, it has all sorts of people from everywhere, and they just want to be there and have a photo with a rider who's in the Tour de France or something. And so they're pushing and shoving, and it's sort of like, I just want to get to the start without getting hurt or missing the stage.
I see what you're saying,
But it's sort of harder to enjoy. Obviously, if you're winning the tour, it's a different story. But if you do have the yellow jersey at the tour, move around. It's like, it's not a simple process. But the tour, it's so big.
Another level.
It's the biggest and prestigious, but it also brings in a lot of excitement outside of cycling.
Oh, Cadell, mate, that's the end. And it was so good to hear. It's just so good to hear from you. You've got so many nice stories to tell, and it's just so fascinating, Cadell, to hear from yourself. And I really appreciate you sharing your time to come on.
Oh, thank you. Nice to delve into a few things. I've been out of the world of cycling just for a week. I've been watching Milan San Remo, but nice to talk to you. And interesting point of Jai's career. Makes me sort of wonder how it's going on. I might be able to catch up with this weekend, so I'll have some more info.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, Cadell 99 ep is going to be next Wednesday, it was just great. So I hope you have a great week, and all the best with the young kids. And
thanks very much. And rides and traveling around, doing my things, looking after kids, and doing those things. But everyone listening, enjoy the racing. This period is interesting. With the races, can I speak about what's coming up? Wout van Aert. I'm really interested to see what he's going to do at the Classics.
What shape is he going to be in?
Yeah, and I suppose as a rider who I really admire, don't know him, but big fan as well, to answer one of your previous questions. But I'm interested to see how he goes this year, amongst many others. Lawrence Pithy, who you had on the show.
Oh, yeah.
That was interesting, and see how if he can continue, how he's going. It was 20th yesterday in... Is it proper?
De Pan,
I didn't ever ride those races, so they're all a bit foreign to me. But he's going strong, and that was interesting. He did a runner, but he can still run fast too.
Yeah, he can.
That was an interesting change in mentalities from being a runner. Normally, runners, when they become bike riders, they become a different spectrum. Certainly not sprinters and what's required to do that. Yeah. But he's crossed over very well in the change of sport and change of mentality. Thanks very much, Jeff. It was really, really good to talk. And everyone in Australia over there, enjoy the racing coming up. It's going to be great. And we got some great Aussies to follow as well in Jai, and Michael Matthews has showed that he's still right there amongst it. And Caleb, hopefully getting over his illnesses. We've got a lot of things to look forward to this year.
Legends, that's another episode of the Press Room Podcast done and dusted. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this episode, pass it on to someone who you think will enjoy it. Mention it in your bunch ride or at the cafe after you've just chopped everyone up in the group sprint. And don't forget to leave a rating as well on Apple, on Spotify, on Google, wherever you listen to it. And check it out on YouTube as well. These are now all on video, full video format, so you can watch it long form, and in my opinion, perfect for the trainer when you're on Zwift. And legends, we've got episode 100 coming up. We're raising the bat a little bit left field, our 100th guest, at the end of a fight to get the guest I wanted. And we have got one of the greatest of all time coming on the pod. So I hope you guys enjoy it. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode.